10. Contract labor not reported to the IRS, like tips, babysitting, errands. B. What have you got to show for it? For the years you have been working for wages, a certain amount of money, which you just calculated, has entered your life. The amount that is left in your life now is your net worth. Be prepared. You will be calculating your net worth, your total assets minus your liabilities, perhaps for the first time in your life. Brace yourself. You may discover that you are deeply in debt, and until this moment you have been unaware of the awful extent of it. Now is the time to face the truth. On the other hand, you may make the delightful discovery that you are in a position to be financially independent now. Many people have made that discovery simply by doing the step. There is an implied challenge in the phrasing of this step. What have you got to show for it? Say that out loud. Use different intonations. It usually comes out sounding a bit critical, snotty even. Your commitment to financial integrity is stronger than your faint-heartedness, however. So on with it. What do you have to show for all those dollars that have entered your life? Let's find out. Creating a snapshot of your net worth simply means going through your material universe and listing everything you own, assets, and everything you owe, liabilities. Liquid assets. Cash, or anything that can be easily converted to cash, belongs in this category. Include the following. Cash on hand. Include the piggy bank, the change in your dresser, the emergency money hidden in the glove compartment. Savings accounts. Look for old bank books that you may have forgotten about, and that account that you open for a minimum of $100 to get the free bonus digital doohickey. Checking accounts. Savings certificates or certificates of deposit. U.S. savings bond. Stocks, list at the current market value. Bonds, list at the current market value. Mutual funds, list at current market value. Money market funds, list at current market value. Brokerage accounts credit balance, life insurance cash value. Fixed assets. In listing these, start with the obvious. The market value of your major possessions, for example, your house, your car, or cars. Contact a real estate agent or search online for the current market value of your house. Consult the Blue Book for the current going price on the make, model, and year of your car. Go through your attic, basement, garage, and storage shed. Itemize everything worth more than a dollar without the subjective evaluation like, that's worthless. Have fortitude. This process alone has been the salvation of several inveterate pack rats, tinkerers, and collectors with garages full of real treasures. If you don't do it now, realize that someone you love will have to do it after you are gone. If your storage area really is piled floor to ceiling with the accumulation of a lifetime, you might want to leave it until last so you don't get overwhelmed. Go through every room and inventory everything. Look up at those decorative light fixtures. Look down at that rug. How about the nice walnut shells you put in a few years ago and those Native American artifacts? What about that custom-built computer? Confront your clutter squarely. Be thorough, but not irrational. That is, not every knife, spoon, and fork has to be listed individually, but do list separately that expensive rosewood-handled carving set with the mahogany case and the two sets of dishes that are still in their boxes. Give an approximate cash value to everything you own. That means current cash value, what you could get for each item at a consignment shop or garage sale or via online auction or classified ad sites. For help in pricing your possessions, look at online auction or classified listings, or the for sale section in your local newspaper. Get your most valuable personal or household items appraised. Don't ignore anything. One person's useless junk is another person's precious antique. Just because you don't value an item doesn't mean it has no value. Don't overlook debts owed you, at least those you can reasonably expect to collect. Include security deposits on utilities, phone, or house or apartment rental. Any material that can be converted into cash should be listed. You are playing the role of appraiser for your own estate. Let it be an enjoyable exercise. You needn't sell any of it if you don't choose, so don't let sentimentality deter you from your inventory. In fact, don't allow any emotions to waylay you. Don't let grief dissuade you from assigning a cash value to the power tools your husband left behind, or the flat-screen TV your roommate left when he or she moved out. Don't let embarrassment about your compulsive spending discourage you from pricing the 20 pairs of shoes sitting unworn in your closet. Don't let guilt keep you from cataloging all the exercise paraphernalia you bought and have never used. Instead, rejoice! You are finally discovering the real value of that stationary bicycle and set of free weights. Not the pounds you'll lose, but the price they'll command at a garage sale. While some people can knock this exercise out in a day or two, one woman took 3 months to do her inventory. She went through every box, looked at every photo, and opened every drawer and cupboard, not only listing the items, but recalling how and why each had come into her life. The process led her to a deep experience of gratitude for what she'd already had. So much dissatisfaction comes from focusing on what we don't have that the simple exercise of acknowledging and valuing what we do have can transform our outlook. Indeed, some people would say that once we're above the survival level, the difference between prosperity and poverty lies simply in our degree of gratitude. Liabilities. This category includes all your debts, whether payable in money, goods, or services, everything you owe, from loans to bills outstanding. If you list as an asset the current market value of your house, include as a liability the balance owed on it. Do the same with the balance on your car payments. Don't forget to include bank loans or loans from friends, credit card debts, student loans, and unpaid medical bills and dental bills. Net worth. Add the figures for liquid assets and fixed assets, and subtract from that the figure for liabilities. In the most simplified, concrete, material sense, this is your current net worth. That is what you currently have to show for your total lifetime income. The rest is memories and illusions, as far as the reality of balance sheets is concerned. We do not include your non-material assets, your education, the skills you have acquired, the goodwill you've bought by treating everyone to a free round of drinks, the tax-deductible receipt from United Way, the increased business that comes your way because you belong to the right club. Valuable as these may be, they are all intangibles, and as such are impossible to evaluate in the crisp, numeric, objective ways that we are learning to apply to our personal finance. The net worth exercise might be humbling or heroic. You will confront many hard truths, which can be painful or liberating. Whatever you find, it's important to remember that net worth does not equal self-worth. Why do a balance sheet? While it might not initially appear so, this point in the program is very encouraging. So far, your financial life has had very little direction or consciousness. Financially speaking, you've been like someone driving around a city without any destination, burning gas, spinning your wheels, and getting nowhere. You may have many happy memories and other intangibles, but only a few real souvenirs that could be converted into cash. With the power and clear direction that taking the reins of your financial affairs will give you, you will be far more effective in the world. You now have an overview of your financial status and can objectively choose whether or not to convert some of your fixed assets into cash, thus increasing your savings or getting a bit further out of debt. One person, upon completing this step, realized that she could liquidate her excess possessions, invest the proceeds, and have enough interest income to immediately be financially independent in comfort and style. While she didn't choose to do that right away, the awareness itself allowed her to take more risks in the direction of her real love, art. Another individual realized that he had many possessions that he wasn't using and no longer wanted, but in hanging on to them because he might just need them someday, his creative solution was to sell those belongings and set aside the proceeds to replace any of them he might need in the future. Meanwhile, his money was earning interest, his life became simpler, and somebody who really needed those items was getting use out of them. And remember, no shame, no blame. In creating your balance sheet, many feelings associated with your material universe may arise. Sadness, grief, nostalgia, hope, guilt, shame, embarrassment, anger. A dispassionate and compassionate attitude can go a long way toward making this step truly enlightening. That is, able to lighten the physical and emotional loads you've been toting around for so many years. Summary of Step 1. A. Find out how much money you've earned in your lifetime. B. Create a balance sheet of your assets and liabilities. What do you have to show for the money you've earned? Money talk questions. It can be surprising, exciting, and even a bit disturbing to discover you have a relationship with money made up of beliefs, assumptions, experiences, admonitions, and perhaps reactions to your parents or culture. Money talks are a perfect way to learn about how others were shaped by their past and what unconscious rules and stories guide us to this day. The no shame, no blame spirit lets you peer behind the curtain of money and see what's going on. Using the suggestions in the epilogue for how to have a money talk, raise these questions in your daily reflections with your partner or in a social group. Remember, adding why to the end of any question will take it deeper. Adding how has society shaped my answer to any question will take it wider. There are no right answers. Who gave you your first lessons about money? And what did you learn? What messages did you get about money growing up? Where did you get them? Parents? Teachers, ads, or talk about an early memory of money and how it affects you now. What does enough mean to you? What do you have in storage or closets that you'd be better off without? And why do you keep it? Chapter 2. Money ain't what it used to be and never was. It wasn't too difficult for Andrea and Kyle W. to do step one. Kyle, a 22-year-old idealist, had been allergic to money for many years. He grew his hair long, rented a small room in a house in a rural area, and considered deep conversation the best entertainment money could buy. Even though, or because, he had avoided money, he had accumulated a $15,000 debt that he planned to pay off someday. When he met Andrea, he was attracted to the thoughtful and dedicated person inside her, not to her lifestyle. It was only after falling in love that he discovered that she was well over $40,000 in debt. Like so many young people, Andrea had equated being on her own with accumulating possessions, furnishing an apartment, and going into debt. Debt was a way of life for her, as it is for so many people, and she was in no rush to pay it off. Play now, pay later, which for her meant working part-time as an administrative assistant to cover immediate expenses and pursuing personal growth. Even when Andrea and Kyle moved in together, she was as leery of Kyle's austerity as he was of her penchant for shopping. When they came to our financial seminar, and Andrea saw the disparity between her desire to become more conscious spiritually and her desire to stay unconscious about her mounting debt, she made a commitment to examine and question her attachment to having nice things. Kyle, in turn, agreed not to push her, to let her discover what was right for her, rather than pressure her to comply with his value system. They decided to get married, and Kyle said, "I do," not only to his beloved, but to nearly quadrupling his debt. Doing step one forced them to face the fact they had a net worth of minus $55,000, and a new way of life was born for them. Once you've done step one for yourself, you too will know how much you are worth. Or will you? Like Andrea and Kyle, you have a dollar figure, we hope a positive one. But what, if anything, does that mean? Our task now is to unravel the mystery of money. What is money anyway? This is an important task because we can't have an effective working relationship with anything or anyone when we don't know what or who it is, or worse, when we identify it as something it is not. Without a universally and consistently true definition of money, our handling of this substance is anywhere from inept to insane, and almost always counter to getting us what we think we want. What is money? We are awash in financial transactions every day, money flowing into salary and investment returns, money flowing out through cash and credit card purchases and recurring payments and interest on debt and taxes. Your phone plan, your internet plan, your car payments, your insurance, your energy consumption in your car and house, your rent or HOA dues or property taxes, service people to fix your car, clean your house or soothe your soul, your tickets to concerts and conferences and vacations, your walking around hungry, grazing from the vendors and restaurants, your clothes and groceries and pet food. Every moment a pinch of money moves in or out, much of it out of sight and mind as electronic blips. It's easy for us to identify money in our lives, but what is it really? What does it represent? Joe Dominguez, the practical genius behind these tools, posed this question to thousands of people attending his 1980s seminar. He'd come on stage in his best Wall Street costuming and pace the front of the stage, looking silently and piercingly at the audience. Then he'd focus on the biggest, toughest-looking guy. Joe was barely 5'7", and bark the question, "How big is yours?" Silence, tittering. "I said," his voice booming, "how big is yours?" Titter, silence. "What are you thinking?" "I'm just asking him how big his paycheck is. Isn't that really the most personal question you can ask a man?" Before anyone can learn anything new, they need to have their cage of certainty rattled. This opener certainly got people off balance and set Joe up for asking, "What is money?" It's a question we never ask because we think we know, or do we? You use the stuff every day. You die for it. You kill for it. Surely you know what it is. Then he'd take out a $100 bill. It's paper. He'd pull in it and twist it and say, pretty strong paper. Then he'd take out a lighter and say, let's test it. See if it burns. Gasp. The room would lurch forward. He'd snap shut the lighter short of putting flame to paper. What was that reaction? Why would burning this piece of paper make you react? Clearly money is more than pieces of paper or metal, or these days plastic, or ones and zeros. So what is this stuff? A brave Economics 101 student might say, money is a means of exchange. Good. I can give you this $100 and buy your wife, right? No. Sometimes at this point, he'd tell the George Bernard Shaw story about Shaw leaning over to a dinner party partner and saying, "Madam, I'll wager you would go to bed for me for $100. She, of course, was shocked and insulted. Then Shaw said, "How about 1,000? And she paused, giving him an opening to say that clearly it's not the act, it's the price. Joe's point was that money is a means of exchange only if the trading partner agrees to its value. Imagine your boat capsized and you swim to an island in a piranha-infested part of the Amazon. You think you're done for, but then you notice that you have your wallet and it's stocked with money, saved. Later, you see two men in a canoe, cannibals, I might add, paddle by and you raise your fistful of dollars yelling, "Help, help!" But they don't recognize your money. They recognize you as dinner. Money is a means of exchange only when both parties agree on its value. It is a fiat currency. It's not even worth the paper it's printed on. "What can you say that is always true about this stuff?" he demanded loudly, waving the $100 bill. Economics 101 would brave another answer. "Oh, it's a store of value," meaning you can save up to spend another day. You can turn a forest, natural value, into lumber, economic value, sell it, and bank the money to pay for future needs. Indeed, this is a major function of money, an abstraction that has allowed us to transform from hunter-gatherer tribes sharing daily harvests into cogs in some industrial wheel who make money by selling our time and talents in the workplace, probably an hour's commute away. "Yes, of course it's a store of value, but consider what happens when bubbles burst and governments fail and hyperinflation sets in and the money that would buy a cow yesterday won't buy a quart of milk today. Money's value can disappear overnight." Had Joe lived long enough, he might have referred to the pensions of Enron employees when the company tanked in 2001, or the Great Recession of 2008, or the Madoff Ponzi scheme that came crashing down in 2009. He might have used the comedian Stephen Colbert's term, truthiness. Store of value is truthy, but it's not true. Oh, you could almost hear the audience think together. The trick is that it isn't the stuff. It's what the stuff means. Another participant would offer, "Money is status." "Yes," Joe would say, "but not always. Other qualities like appearance or intellect or family reputation might confer more status than ostentatious wealth on display in the winter watering holes of the Nouveau Riche." "It's power," another would try. "You can make people do things with money. You can buy favors. You can influence. Look at lobbyists. Look at dark money in politics. Look at arms deals." "Yes, yes," Joe would say, "but you have to admit there are other forms of power that may win the day. Think of Gandhi and the British leaving India. Think of Martin Luther King Jr. Think of all the myths and stories and movies about the little guy with integrity beating out the evil giants. Money is no guarantee of power, though it is often used to wield power." "Okay, now I get it," they cry. "Money is evil. It's the root of all evil." A student of the Bible, Joe would counter, "No, the love of money is the root of all evil, not money itself. It's a tool of repression. It's not fair. It's a mystery. It's not important. It's abundant. It's how we keep score." One guess after another, each one with a bit more lightness, because the audience would realize there was a trick somewhere they couldn't see. No definition would stick. All are true sometimes. None are true, always. You could practically hear a collective decision to unload all known definitions for Joe to shoot down one by one and finally get to the punchline. And as merciless as Joe seemed, swatting guesses like annoying flies, people could feel the love underneath, especially because he knew he was not standing up there, flapping his arms, giving voice to our fears and half-truths for fame or fortune. We'd formed a charitable foundation, the New Roadmap Foundation, to give all the proceeds away, every penny from every seminar. We weren't rich. We each lived on less than $800 a month, but we had enough and loved using these seminars to raise money for other organizations. Finally, he'd agree to share the secret. Here is the one thing you can say that is always true for you 100% of the time. Money is something you trade your life energy for. You sell your time for money. It doesn't matter that Ned over there sells his time for $100 and you sell your time for $20 an hour. Ned's money is irrelevant to you. The only real asset you have is your time, the hours of your life. You're born. You have about 8,800 hours in a year, maybe 650,000 of those hours before you die. You'll easily spend half of them sleeping and keeping your body fed, clothed, and reasonably comfortable. Maybe you're already halfway through your life, meaning you're down to 150,000 hours left to spend. This is your treasure. This is all you have for everything that matters to you. The love of your family, your contribution to society, your enjoyment of the great outdoors, your rising to challenges, your search for meaning, your legacy, your ecstasies in church or in bed, your life. And you sell some of those precious hours for this, waving the $100 bill. This has no meaning. Your time is where all meaning and value lie. Knowing that money is simply your life energy puts you in the driver's seat of your money life. How much of my life am I willing to sell to have money in my pocket? Looking around at your accumulation of stuff, you can ask, how many hours of my life did I invest to have this chair, car, matched set of cookware, diploma on the wall? See what this does to your next purchase. This program does not promise more or less money or stuff. It only promises to transform your relationship with money. Did you ever think about that, Joe would ask, that you have a relationship with money? He'd get on his knees, begging money to love him. He'd exhibit mock terror, shrinking from the evil $100 bill. He'd hold it out like a carrot and run around after it, reaching but never grasping it. This is what your relationship with money looks like. Think about it. If you were money, would you hang out with you? A simple summary of what money is and is not. Joe's antics took audiences rapidly through four levels of misunderstanding about what money is and isn't. Material, the pieces of paper and metal and plastic, the daily transactions of earning and spending, of banking and investing. This mundane level is what most people most of the time think of as money. Psychological, your fears and longing, your personality. Are you modest or flamboyant? The last of the big time spenders or a tightwad? Who influenced your feelings and thoughts about money? Cultural, the beliefs embedded in our laws and customs. More is better. Growth is good. Winners and losers. Private property. Rewards and punishment. Do you recognize these as the warp onto which you've woven your money life? Life energy, something you trade the hours of your life for. The first three layers are real and important, but not always. In fact, simply getting up to date with the material level of money can bring immense peace of mind. Understanding how your money psychologically affects the money choices of your daily life brings an even greater level of freedom. Seeing how you are unwittingly living some of the beliefs of our culture can further liberate you from unconscious habits. Is more really better? Is growth really good? The last is the big one. Knowing that money is your life energy transforms your relationship with money, shining a bright light on all your false notions. This program promises to clear out the fog and the confusion, the myths and mistaken notions we have in our relationship with money. It promises we will be at peace with our choices. The key to transforming our relationship with money is this utter clarity that money is not all the meanings we project on it, nor is it the dark realities of the financial system. It is something we choose to trade our life energy for. While the insight that money is life energy comes in an instant, living that truth is a lifelong path of discovery. It isn't a magic wand vaporizing the consequences of your past money mistakes. You still grew up in a family where your parents battled over money or hid problems or used it like a carrot or a stick. You still came of age in circumstances in which money came hard or easy, in which hard knocks or golden opportunities made a big difference. You still have your debt. You still have your disagreements with your partner. Even once you change your relationship with money, it will still make concrete demands on you. It is like a hard-edged, many-faceted diamond, and your obligations are real. Checks bounce, products break, salaries are negotiated, doctor bills come due, mortgages get paid or not, and your fortune changes. Knowing money is life energy doesn't change the requirement that you treat your obligations with the utmost integrity. Money is also like water. It flows. And as it flows, it nourishes life. We feel happy when it flows our way, distressed when it doesn't. We buy gifts of love and brighten others' days. We turn a bonus into a trip to Hawaii with the family and make memories. Knowing money is life energy doesn't flatten our emotional responses as it flows through our lives. Examining its role in our lives can actually make our experience richer. Rather than thinking that buying a new car will make us happy, we can wonder what does make us happy and whether happy could come from a day at the beach rather than 3 years of monthly car payments. Money is like a mirror that allows us to see ourselves. Notice what happens when you get a check in the mail. A bill, when your partner says, "Honey, we have to talk about our finances." Notice how you feel when you tip well, tip poorly, when someone notices you have an expensive watch. The more we clarify this watery feeling aspect of money, the better equipped we are to deal with those hard daily transactions, fewer overdrafts and late fees, more control over spending, better timeliness with taxes and bill paying. The clearer our feelings, the cleaner our transactions. Money is a game, and we have to play by the rules. Like it or not, we are all in the money game. By playing by the game rules, we can sell our services and products locally and globally. We can buy products with components mined in Africa and Venezuela, assembled in China, Brandon in Los Angeles, packaged in the Philippines, and sold at Walmarts everywhere. Our credit card purchases are reconciled daily by some vast set of computers whirring away, and we take home groceries and buy tickets for concerts. We live and move and have our being in this money game, and we understand one another through the language of these transactions. Everyone needs money. Everyone hustles to get it. Few of us could live for a day of our lives without touching something that money has touched. Because of that, our minds resist looking squarely at how dependent and embedded we are. Money may be life energy, but daily life grinds to a halt without it. Knowing this shared game aspect of money, though, gives us a way to make conscious choices about when we play the game using money, and when we play the game using other currencies, like love, or skills, or knowledge, or the work of our hands. We can see how the money game plays us as well, how malls and department stores and websites are all designed to grab our attention and our money, playing on our insecurities and our longings. Resisting consumerism becomes easy. Is that bathing suit or car really worth my life energy? Many of our assumptions about money are really part of the game design. whoever dies with the most toys wins, is part of the design to keep us all in the system and playing. Upgrading your technology is part of the game design. Planned or manufactured obsolescence, fashion is part of the game. Starter homes, advertisements showing beautiful women and muscular men decorated with products for you to purchase. Or the grander scale, the interstate highway and cathedrals are part of the money game. Most of us decide to ignore the bad and try to use money for the good. Look, it's all part of the game, we tell ourselves. The only game in town. The game feeds on players being involved. If players lose interest, the game collapses, which horrifies us. We depend on money for just about everything. Buy something, feed the economy. Everyone wins if we all play. This game comes complete with bad guys, the boogeymen of personal finances that keep us in line and playing. Inflation, cost of living, recession, and depression. We are encouraged to take economic indicators personally. If the economist gods announce the economy is in recession, we might decide not to go on a vacation this year just to be safe, even if we have plenty of money and a secure job. If the economist gods tell us the cost of living is up, we automatically feel poorer, even though what's now included in the consumer price index was a luxury item just a few decades ago, something we all did without and never missed, like our cell phones and other technological doodads. Some would call this design aspect of money the Matrix, a simulated reality created by sentient machines to subdue the human population and harvest their energy. In the film, Morpheus, a leader of the liberated humans, tells Neo, the hero, "The Matrix is everywhere. It is all around us. Even now, in this very room, you can see it when you look at your window or when you turn on your television. You can feel it when you go to work, when you go to church, when you pay your taxes. It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth." Morpheus offers Neo a choice, now famous in pop culture. You take the blue pill, the story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill, you stay in Wonderland. Knowing that money is life energy is like taking the red pill. You see your choices, make them, and see the consequences, and learn. Winning isn't having the most toys. It's having precisely what you need and nothing in excess, and being able to stop playing the game at will. Knowing money is life energy allows you to maximize and optimize your most precious resource, your time, your life. Your life energy. What does money equals life energy mean to you? After all, money is something you consider valuable enough to devote easily a quarter of your allotted time on earth to getting, spending, worrying about, fantasizing about, or in some other way reacting to. Yes, there are many social conventions regarding money that are worth learning and abiding by. But ultimately, you are the one who determines what money is worth to you. It is your life energy. You pay for money with your time. You choose how to spend it. This definition of money gives us significant information. Our life energy is more real in our actual experience than money. While money has no intrinsic reality, our life energy does, at least to us. It's tangible and it's finite. Life energy is all we have. It's precious because it is limited and irretrievable, and because our choices about how we use it express the meaning and purpose of our time here on Earth. If you are 40 years old, you can expect to have approximately 356,500 hours, 40.7 years, of life energy left before you die. See figure 2.1 for life expectancy at variable ages in your PDF. Assuming about half your time is spent on necessary body maintenance, sleeping, eating, eliminating, washing, and exercising, you have 178,000 hours of life energy remaining for such discretionary uses as your relationship with yourself, your relationship with others, your creative expression, your contribution to your community, your contribution to the world, achieving inner peace, and holding down a job. Now that you know that money is something you trade your life energy for, you have an opportunity to set new priorities for your use of that most valuable commodity. After all, is there anything more valuable to you than your life energy? A first look at financial independence. As we said in the introduction, one purpose of this audio is to increase your financial independence. By following the steps, you will move inexorably toward financial integrity and financial intelligence, and will one day, we hope before you die, arrive at financial independence. In showing you how this is possible, however, we must first show you what financial independence isn't. Let's begin by exploring what images the phrase financial independence conjures up for you. Making a killing, inheriting a fortune, winning the lottery, cruises, tropical islands, world travel, jewels, Porsches, designer clothes. Most of us picture financial independence as an unreachable fantasy of inexhaustible riches. This is financial independence at a material level. While it simply requires that we be rich, there's a caveat. What is rich? Rich exists only in comparison to something or someone else. Rich is a hell of a lot more than I have now. Rich is way more than most other people have. But we know the fallacy of the myth of more. More is like a mirage. We can never reach it because it isn't real. John Stuart Mill once said, "Men do not desire to be rich, only to be richer than other men." In other words, as soon as rich becomes available to the likes of us, it will no longer be rich. Only when we take personal responsibility for our relationship with money does the first definition of true financial independence appear. Our definition of financial independence cuts through the Gordian knot of not knowing what rich is. Financial independence has nothing to do with rich. It is the experience of having enough and then some. Enough, you will remember, is found at the peak of the fulfillment curve. It is quantifiable, and you will define it for yourself as you work with the steps in this program. The old notion of financial independence as being rich forever is not achievable. Enough is. Enough for you may be different from enough for your neighbor, but it will be a figure that is real for you and within your reach. Financial and psychological freedom. Your first step toward the experience of having enough and then some is liberating your mind from the pre-existing attitudes towards money. Until you do so, no amount of money will free you. Once you have, you are free from unconsciously held assumptions about money, and free of the guilt, resentment, envy, frustration, and despair you may have felt about money issues. You may have these feelings, but you don't have them the way you have an article of clothing. You can try it on, but you are free at any time to take it off. You are no longer compelled by the parental and social messages you received as a child. Messages about how we should relate to money in order to be successful, respected, virtuous, secure, and happy. You are free of the confusion you had about money. You are no longer intimidated by the financial professionals you hire to do your taxes or invest your money. You never buy things you don't want or need, and you are immune to the seductiveness of malls, markets, and the media. Your emotional fortunes are no longer tied to your economic fortunes. Your moods don't swing with the Dow Jones band. The broken record in your mind stops. The one that calculates hours till quitting time, days till payday, paydays till you have a down payment for a motorcycle, costs for the next home improvement project, and years till retirement. The silence at first is thundering. Days and even weeks can go by without you thinking about money, without you mentally reaching for your wallet to handle life's challenges and opportunities. When you are financially independent, the way money functions in your life is determined by you, not by your circumstances. In this way, money isn't something that happens to you. It's something you include in your life in a purposeful way. From this point of view, the normal drama of 9 to 5 to your 65, of making a dying, of getting ahead, of being rich and famous, all these brass rings we automatically reach for can be seen as just one series of choices among many. Financial independence is freedom from the fog, fear, and fanaticism so many of us feel about money. If this sounds like peace of mind, well, it is. Fiscal bliss. And if this sounds as unattainable as being rich, it isn't. It's been the experience of tens of thousands of people who have followed the approach to money described in this book, who have done the practical steps recommended. Step 2, being in the present, tracking your life energy. How does this great truth, money is life energy, manifest itself in your life? When you thought money was just something to deal with, or that it was security, power, or tool of the devil, or the grand prize in your life, you could rationalize your behavior in terms of shoulds and oughts. But now you know that money is life energy, your life energy, and you have a rising interest in knowing just how much of the stuff is actually passing through your hands. Step 2 on the road to financial freedom is where you satisfy this curiosity. There are two parts to the step. A. Establish the actual costs in time and money required to maintain your job or jobs and compute your real hourly wage. B. Keep track of every cent that comes into or goes out of your life. A. How much are you trading your life energy for? We have established that money is simply something you trade your life energy for. Now let's look at how much life energy in hours you are currently trading for how much money in dollars. That is, how much money are you making for the amount of time you work? Most people look at this life energy to earnings ratio in an unrealistic and inadequate way. I earn $1,000 a week, I work 40 hours a week, so I trade 1 hour of my life energy for $25. It's not likely to be that simple. Think of all the ways you use your life energy that are directly related to your money-earning employment. Think of all the monetary expenses that are directly associated with your job. In other words, if you didn't need that money-earning job, what time expenditure and money expenses would disappear from your life? Be prepared to be surprised. Some people resent their work, the hours of drudgery, the boredom, the office politics, time away from what they really want to be doing, the personality conflicts with their boss or coworkers. Feeling powerless, they indulge instead in some retail therapy. Be prepared to discover how much you spend with I hate my job, as the underlying reason. Be prepared, too, to discover how much you spend on expensive alternatives to cooking, cleaning, repairs, and other things you would do for yourself if you didn't have to work. Be prepared to discover the many costs of ambition, all the things you must have in order to continue up the ranks, the right car, the right clothes, the right house, and the right neighborhood, and the right city. The right private schools for your kids. Using the following discussion as a stimulus, discover for yourself the real trade-offs in time and energy associated with keeping your 9-to-5 job. Not all the categories will necessarily apply to you, and you may think of others relevant to you that are not mentioned here. For freelancers, this might be extra complicated, but the value will be even greater. You'll subject each gig to the same analysis. You may be surprised that you are undervaluing some of your jobs and overvaluing others. In the following examples, we will assign arbitrary numeric values to these time and money trade-offs simply to generate a hypothetical tabulation. At the end of the discussion, we will tabulate these calculations and come up with an actual exchange rate of life energy for money. When you do your own calculations, you will be using your actual figures and will determine your own personal hourly wage. Commuting. Getting to and from work incurs an expenditure of time or money or both, whether you drive a car you own, grab a cab, ride share, bicycle, walk, or take public transportation. For our purposes here, let's assume you commute by car. Don't forget to include parking fees and tolls for bridges or turnpikes, as well as wear and tear on your car. Let's say you commute 1.5 hours a day, or 7.5 hours a week, at a cost in gas and maintenance of $100 a week. If you use mass transit, your figures will be somewhat different. 7.5 hours per week, $100 per week. Costuming. Are the clothes you wear at work the same ones you wear on your days off or on vacation? Or do you need a special wardrobe to be appropriately attired for your job? This includes not just the obvious costumes like nurses' uniforms, construction workers' steel-toed boots, and chef's aprons, but also the tailored suits and the high-heeled shoes, the neckties and pantyhose that are the norm in offices. Look at those clothes. Would you wear a noose around your neck or walk around on 3-inch heels every day if it weren't expected for the job? Consider, too, the time and money spent on personal grooming, from aftershave to exotic cosmetics. Quantify all your costuming activities, from shopping to putting on mascara, shaving, and tying your tie. Let's say you spend 1.5 hours a week on this at an average cost of $25 a week. i.e., annual clothing expense divided by 52 weeks, plus cost of cosmetics. That's 1.5 hours per week, $25 per week. Meals. Extra costs in time and money for meals affected by your job take many forms. For example, money for morning and afternoon coffee, time spent in line in the employee's cafeteria, and meals ordered in or eaten out because you're too tired or busy to cook dinner. Let's say you spend a total of 5 hours a week out to lunch or stopping for a morning coffee. Your lunches at the local deli cost about $30 a week more than if you'd made lunch at home, and the latte breaks you treat yourself to as a reward for working come to $20 a week. Total spent? $50. That's 5 hours per week, $50 per week. Daily decompression. Do you come home from your job zestful and full of life, joyously launching into personal or planetary projects or into intimate sharing with your family or other loved ones? Or are you tired and drained, taciturnly lurching into the soft chair in front of the television set or computer screen, beer or martini in hand, because it's been such a day? If it takes a while for you to decompress from the pressures of the job, that while is a job-related expense. Include in this calculation the time you spent ranting about your job and your coworkers to whoever will listen. A wild guess would put this at 5 hours a week and $30 a week in recreational substances. That's 5 hours per week, $30 per week. Escape entertainment. Notice that common phrase, escape entertainment. Escape from what? What is the prison or restrictive circumstance from which you must flee? If your experience of life was consistently fulfilling and exciting, from what would you escape? Would you devote so many hours to screen time? Take a look at scenarios like, it's been such a heavy week at work, let's have a night on the town to blow it off. Or, let's get away from it all this weekend and go to Vegas. Would these be necessary? What are the costs in life energy and money? How much of your weekend entertainment do you consider your just reward for sticking it out at a boring job? Of course, some consumption of the arts deliciously disturbs and blindly inspires and deeply nourishes. Life energy spent here makes life worth living, and so it's worth every second. This absorption into art is not about escape, it's about elevation, and as such, isn't a job-related expense. Let's assign escape entertainment 5 hours and $40 a week. That's 5 hours per week, $40 a week. Vacations. Time in nature and travel to other cultures and places can be, like art, the best experiences of your life. But if vacationing is more like time out in a corner to recover so you can get back into the fight, then it's a job-related expense. For example, if you are too tired to even plan a special trip and decide to just take the whole family to a resort in the Bahamas where you will collapse in a lounge chair rather than a lazy boy at home, this might be a job-related expense. However, if you sell off everything from your storage unit to volunteer for a week with a research team in the Bahamas measuring the health of the coral reefs, that may count as diving into life, literally. Only you know which is which. What else? How about the vacation home, boat, or recreational vehicle that you use only a few weeks each year to get away? String all this out, divided by 52, and you might have 5 hours and $30 a week for absenting yourself from the daily grind. That's 5 hours per week and $30 per week. Job-related illness. What percentage of illness is job-related? Induced by stress, by physical work conditions, by the desire to have a legitimate reason to take time off from work, or by conflict with employers or fellow employees. The Greater Good Science Center, an organization promoting science-based practices for a meaningful life, gathered research about health and happiness. They found evidence that happiness increases heart health, strengthens the immune system, combats stress, reduces aches and pains, reduces chronic illness, and lengthens our lives. In our own experience over the years, we have seen considerably less illness, and illness-caused absenteeism in volunteers than in paid employees. Stated simply, happy, fulfilled people are healthier. For this category, a more subjective inner sensing is the only way to evaluate what percentage of medical costs in time and money is attributable to your job. Let's guesstimate $25 a week to out-of-pocket expenses, co-pays, medications, for all job-related illness expenses, and add 50 hours a year for visits to the doctor, trips to the drugstore, and sniffling under the covers. That's 1 hour a week, $25 a week. Other job-related expenses. Examine your balance sheet of assets and liabilities from step one. Are items listed there that you wouldn't have bought had they not been directly related to your job? Look at what you pay the help. Would you need a housekeeper, gardener, handyman, or nanny if you didn't have a job? Daycare expenses for single parents or two-income families take a big chunk out of your salary and wouldn't be necessary if you didn't have a job. Do a time log for a typical week. How many hours accounted for are strictly job-related? Things like perusing online job listings or social evenings to network for business. Are the hours of taking your frustrations about work out on your partner a job-related activity? As you progress through the other steps in this program, make special note of such hidden job-related expenses. Don't overlook job enhancement expenses, such as educational programs, books, tools, and conferences. Remember, your situation is unique, but the basic ideas will apply. Discover your own categories of job-related time and money expenses. Your real hourly wage. Now compile these figures and create a table, adding the approximate extra job-related hours to your normal work week and subtracting the job-related expenses from your usual pay. On longer-term items, like vacations or illness, simply prorate over 50 weeks. 1 year, minus 2 weeks for your vacation, presuming you have a job that gives you a vacation at all. A $1,500 vacation that you wouldn't have taken if you enjoyed your job would be computed as $1,500 divided by 50 weeks equals $30 a week, and so on. The specific entries will be approximations, of course, but with diligence, you can come up with fairly accurate